From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Christine Blasey Ford wants an FBI investigation of her accusation that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her while they were both in high school. She wants that before she testifies before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Democrats have picked up the call. Here is Senator Mazie Hirono speaking to CNN this morning.
This is the kind of investigation that the FBI is supposed to be doing. This is new information that they got. They should be able to do their jobs. And who's stopping them right now? It's the president. It's the administration.
Republicans on the committee have instead urged Ford to testify about the allegation at Monday's hearing without an FBI investigation. NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow is with me in the studio here in Washington today. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley has said he still plans to hold a hearing on Monday as scheduled, even if Ford doesn't attend. What are the politics here?
A lot of politics here. Republicans said they took this accusation seriously and they want to hear from Ford. And they said Monday is the day to hear from her. They're not budging on that. They're not open to the idea of pushing the hearing back, waiting for an investigation. They're saying, we take you seriously, and Monday is the day to do it. Now, of course, Democrats are saying that's ridiculous, that this needs to be looked at further. And now you heard from Ford saying that she's not going to testify unless there's a further FBI investigation. I think it's very unclear what happens next. I think there's a lot of political risk to having a hearing where Kavanaugh testifies and that's it. And I think Democrats aren't sure what they would do if that's the case. But I've heard several Democrats talk about the idea of even just outright boycotting the hearing if that's what happens.
Well, and you wonder if some of the Republicans, like Senator Jeff Flake, would be okay with that as well if it was just Kavanaugh testifying and not Ford.
Yeah, you have seen Flake and Bob Corker, who were two voices who said it was clear they wanted to hit pause and hear from Ford. They've walked that back a little bit. And Bob Corker has said, hey, if she doesn't testify Monday, we should move forward and hold a vote.
Mm-hmm.
Flake has not gone that far, but he's saying he's urging Ford to testify on Monday. He doesn't seem to be open to the idea of delaying the hearing.
President Trump talked to reporters this morning before he boarded a plane to North Carolina, and he answered questions about the accusation and blamed Democrats for bringing it forward so late in the confirmation process. Here he is.
We've held up the whole hearing. What I don't like is that Senator Feinstein had this letter for a period of like 3 months from July, maybe even before that, but from July. Why didn't Senator Feinstein bring this up at her meeting with Judge Kavanaugh?
The president is referring there to California Democrat Dianne Feinstein. Does the president have a point in laying some blame for this situation at her feet?
Feinstein's come under a lot of criticism for sitting on this letter. It wasn't 3 months, as the president said. It was a period of about 5 weeks. Feinstein said she did that because Ford had contacted her, but Ford did not want to go public with her allegation. But even though she has her legitimate reasons for making that decision of not sharing this information, that is something a lot of Republicans are pointing to. They're saying if Democrats think this is a serious allegation that the FBI should be investigating, then they should have contacted, they should have made this information known to the White House, to Chairman Grassley, at an earlier period and not waited until the last week.
As everyone knows, President Trump himself has been accused of sexual misconduct. How does the White House handling and Republican handling of this situation affect their chances in the midterm? And how much are they thinking about President Trump?
A lot. They're thinking about that a lot. You're right. Republicans, even before this, have had major problems with women voters, high education, high income women voters especially. And I think one senator to look at to see how careful Republicans are treading here is Ted Cruz. He's a member of the Judiciary Committee who's up for re-election this year in a race that's closer than he expected it to be. He has been incredibly careful, either not talking to reporters or issuing very carefully worded statements saying he looks forward to hearing to Ford's allegations. He takes them seriously. He is not questioning her credibility or anything like that.
Do you think there's any chance there's going to be an FBI investigation?
Probably not. Probably not, because the White House doesn't want one. I think my understanding is when it comes to looking into job applications, background checks, that happens at the request of the White House. They have no indication they want one.
A lot of people have been comparing this to Clarence Thomas's confirmation and Anita Hill, who accused him of sexual harassment. This was back in 1991. The FBI did investigate her claims before she testified. And now she wants the FBI to investigate Ford's claim and not to rush the hearing. Here she is on Good Morning America on ABC.
The hearing questions need to have a frame, and the investigation is the best frame for that, a neutral investigation that can pull together the facts, create a record so that the senators can draw on the information they receive to develop their questions.
Now, Scott, you say you don't think that there's going to be an FBI investigation. Senators are gone now, right? The rest of this week, nothing's going to happen on this in the next several days. But then there's going to be a hearing on Monday, one way or the other.
Right. Or it could be canceled. I mean, I think honestly, at this moment, we really don't know. And I think that a lot of listeners may cringe at viewing this through the idea of political momentum and political power. But that's how justices are confirmed or not confirmed. And I think earlier in the week, Democrats felt like momentum was going their way, that these allegations were being taken seriously. But now that Ford is balking at testifying Monday, I think Republicans feel like they can say, hey, we gave you a fair chance. You didn't come. We have to move forward.
We will be watching what happens. NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow, thank you.
Thank you.
The death toll from Hurricane Florence has risen to at least 37 people in three states. President Trump is in the Carolinas today to view the damage. With many communities still underwater, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper is pleading with the thousands of evacuees to be patient as recovery efforts continue and to not return home. Even so, a few evacuees have been venturing back to their flooded neighborhoods to try to assess their losses. Jay Price from member station WUNC was with a group of friends and neighbors near the town of Lumberton on the South Carolina border.
The flooding here is much like it was 2 years ago after Hurricane Matthew. So bad that in most places, people trying to check on their homes are stopped by flooded roads or police before they can get close. But in an unnamed neighborhood just south of the city, a dozen or so residents have turned the two entrances into their U-shaped neighborhood into impromptu boat ramps.
But he hadn't sold it yet. Now it's on the water. He'll sell it now.
They're launching a ragtag flotilla of half a dozen canoes and aluminum John boats to check the damage to their homes and retrieve anything important they left behind. Most left when the water was still just filling ditches. Now it's nearly up to their mailboxes. Lydia Locklear, a retired home health care worker, is known in the neighborhood by her middle name, Marie. She's been having flashbacks about Hurricane Matthew when she lost everything in her mobile home, a new car, and a truck. When Florence hit, she evacuated to her son-in-law's house, but she heard that a makeshift berm to block the rising Lumber River had failed, and water was pouring into the same place it had 2 years ago. That made for a hard night.
I couldn't sleep. I said, Lord, my house underwater again. I was panicking. I woke everybody up. Get up and worry with me.
Get up and worry with me. Locklear says she and her neighbors learned hard lessons in Matthew. One was to get out early so they didn't have to be evacuated again by boat. Another was to not trust official guesses about how likely another flood was or how high another flood could get.
And all the permits said I had to go, it had to go higher than the water went last time. And everybody's talking about, well, if you flood one time, you flood again. So I said, well, let's just go higher.
So after Hurricane Matthew, she had the workers build up her yard a foot higher than required. But she wasn't sure if she really had built it up high enough for this flood and whether she'd have to start over again. Bo Scott, a relative of one resident, said he'd take her to find out. Locklear said no.
I got a life jacket.
But if you fall over, you can get
up. Life jacket's too,
so. You got anything you need to get out?
You want to go?
But her neighbors ribbed her until she relented and climbed into the boat. While she was checking for damage, other neighbors watched, just happy for the tiny bit of normalcy of being around each other again. Tammy Maynor, who lives across the street from Locklear, had come with her husband, Gerald. They had already been to their house.
We just basically come to check the house to see it, because yesterday the waters hadn't got in our house yet. They were in our duct. We still had about that much before it came in on the floors. And so we came back today to just, you know, basically look to see if it had came in, and it has.
Last time, the rising water caught them off guard, and they escaped with just one big bag of clothes. After that, they bought an enclosed trailer. They used it to move their possessions out early this time. Matthew had lifted water waist high inside, and it had taken them 5 months to get the house at least habitable. Now, they have more work to do.
But it don't hurt like it did the last time, let me tell you. I cried so many tears the last time I could have filled this place up again 10 times. I lost 15 pounds. My husband lost 15 pounds. We couldn't eat.
The small neighborhood is close-knit. There's a lot of love here, is the way Maynor puts it.
That's why we came back after the flood, because we said this is home.
Then Scott brings Locklear back from inspecting her home, sitting stoically in the front of the little boat and trying to ignore her friend's ribbing about cavorting with young men in boats.
I just don't know what to think. You got back here and reached on all kinds of men over here.
Hey, come on.
They help her out and ask if she brought anything back from her mobile home. She says no because she's got good news.
I didn't get nothing. There's no water in there, so I didn't take out nothing.
So she did build up her home high enough, this time. For Here and Now, I'm Jay Price, reporting from Lumberton, North Carolina.
The murder trial of the Chicago police officer who shot 17-year-old Laquan McDonald is in its third day today. Shannon Heffernan is criminal justice reporter for WBEZ and is covering the trial. Shannon, remind us first of the details of this case. What happened?
So this was an incident in 2014 when Officer Jason Van Dyke arrived on a scene where there were already other police officers present. He opened fire within about 6 seconds of arriving on the scene and shot Laquan McDonald 16 times, including after he was already lying on the ground. Laquan McDonald was carrying a knife and walking down the street. A little bit earlier, he had punctured the tire of a police car.
And the police union has said that Officer Van Dyke shot him in self-defense, but dash cam video showed the suspect was actually walking away at the time that he was shot. The first 2 days of the trial, we know, were eventful. Officer Van Dyke's partner, took the stand yesterday. What did he say?
Well, he said what he's been saying all along, which is that Laquan McDonald appeared to be a threat. He talked about him locking eyes on the officer, and he stuck to his story that he appeared like he was going to attack them. Now, I should say here that Van Dyke's partner is currently also on trial. It's a conspiracy trial for basically trying to distort the facts about what happened that night. That's a separate trial, and that's going to get underway later this fall.
Opening statements in this trial were heard earlier in the week. What do we learn about how prosecutors are approaching the case?
Prosecutors are painting a picture of Jason Van Dyke as an officer who arrived on scene and, without carefully assessing, began shooting. They describe a scene where there were many officers who were present and armed, and the scene was under control. They talk about how shooting once, let alone 16 times, was not necessary. During their opening statements, they actually counted down all 16 shots that Van Dyke made and showed jurors a video of the incident.
The dash cam video, is that what they showed?
The dash cam video, exactly. And they've been showing that a lot. About over half a dozen times the jury has already seen that video.
And what's the defense saying?
The defense is trying to put Laquan McDonald on trial alongside Van Dyke. They talk about how he was on a rampage that night. That's their language. They are bringing up the fact that he was using a bus pass that night that belonged to somebody else and was crisscrossing across the city. They really want to paint a picture of the officer as somebody who had to shoot to keep people safe on the scene that night.
Shannon Heffernan, who's covering the trial for WBEZ and contributing to the ongoing podcast about the case. It's called 16 Shots, and we'll link to it at hereandnow.org. Shannon, thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We're also watching what's happening in Dallas, where a 26-year-old black man named Botham Jean was shot and killed in his apartment about 2 weeks ago by an off-duty white police officer. That officer, Amber Geiger, claims she entered his apartment by mistake and thought he was an intruder in her apartment. She lives in the same building. She fired 2 shots and is now facing manslaughter charges. The district attorney in Dallas, Faith Johnson, is taking up the case. She is Dallas County's first black female district attorney and was appointed in 2016 by Republican Governor Greg Abbott. She's also a Republican and is up for re-election in November against Democrat John Cruzo. Since taking office, she has indicted officers several times and even secured a rare murder conviction. Faith Johnson joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate being on your show.
Well, on the day you were appointed as district attorney, you said you wanted to make the DA's office the people's office. How is prosecuting police officers part of that mission?
Only to say that we are here for justice, equality. So it's not that we are trying to prosecute a police officer to say, hey, we're going to go out there and prosecute police officers. We're just simply saying we want to prosecute anybody who's going to break the law, whether you're a police officer or non-police officer. Because keep in mind, I love police. So I know it's always a reluctancy on behalf of district attorneys all over the country, rather. They do not want to do that. They feel hesitant because, you know, a lot of times we do partner with the police. We do work different offenses together. But we have to still say we are not going to tolerate bad apples doing bad things to good people, innocent people. We can't tolerate that.
But is there anything unique about being a police officer, though, just because of the line of work that maybe they, and they have argued successfully in the past that, well, I was worried for my safety, and so therefore I took this action where if I took that action, I would be charged, but maybe because they're a police officer, that they're not.
It's not so much because they're a police officer. There are certain cases where there's a good shoot, and that's what we usually call it here. It's a good shooting. So there are situations where you don't have that scenario where, wow, yeah, he couldn't help himself. He had to do what he had to do. And some of these cases aren't that. There are cases where an officer literally has broken the law. So those are the cases we're prosecuting. I think that's what people need to understand. Our commitment is to make certain that we bring all of the facts to the grand jury, so the grand jury will know what really happened out there.
So how do you differ, do you think, from your predecessors in holding officers accountable when they use deadly force?
I don't know what their thoughts were. I just know in 45 years, no officer has actually been convicted of murder. My commitment to the people of Dallas County is that I came into this office with the thought that I just wanted to be fair. And you know something, Jeremy? I think everybody throughout the country want that.
So how difficult of a case do you think you have when it comes to Amber Geiger, the officer who shot and killed Botham Jean in his apartment just recently?
Well, we can't talk about the facts. And the only thing I can say to you is that we are investigating that case. It's still ongoing. And we haven't slowed up. We're looking at every conceivable possible thing that we can look at to be able to bring this case to the grand jury. And it won't be tomorrow, it won't be next week, because we say to people, we want to get it right. We're not necessarily concerned about doing it quick, but we're concerned about making certain that it's right. Now, a lot of people are thinking that, oh, well, why didn't the DA go out there and arrest her? Well, what they need to understand is that we received this case from the Texas Rangers. We had nothing to do with their investigation as it relates to manslaughter, whether or not they decided they need to arrest her before that, whether or not she ought to be fired. We have nothing to do with any of that.
When you look around the country outside of Dallas County, and you see stories about Michael Brown in Ferguson or Eric Garner in Staten Island or other African-Americans who have been hurt or killed by police officers, what do you think when you see those stories? What do you think the problem is?
You know, we knew when we went into other cases. For example, we tried the Roy Oliver case, and we were able to successfully get a guilty verdict. And as I indicated earlier, there had been no guilty verdict in Dallas County in 45 years.
This is Roy Oliver, by the way, former police officer who shot and killed Jordan Edwards, who was an unarmed black 15-year-old.
Yes, yes. And we prosecuted that case. That killing was last year. And we tried him just recently. We got the guilty verdict. And it was a historic verdict. People rejoiced all over the, not just all over the country, but all over the world. And you know why they did that? They did that because of all the cases you just mentioned. So many people had had their day in court, and those officers were found not guilty. And people were really losing faith in the criminal justice system, because that's exactly what they were saying. Hey, is there any justice in America? And that's not that I speak to those cases. I just speak to the fact that we tried a case, and we were able to get a guilty verdict, not for manslaughter, but for murder. And we will continue to bring justice, because we're just simply saying is that we want equal justice for everybody, and we don't want anyone to have favoritism over one citizen over another. That's just my commitment.
So why a manslaughter charge and not a murder charge for Officer Geiger?
That's what you need to ask the Texas Rangers. They came out without arrest. You got to remember, we had nothing to do with the charges or the arrest, because we're not the arresting agency. We are the prosecution. We're the one who is preparing this case for the grand jury. The grand jury comes back with whatever they come back with. We're going to present the law to them. We're going to present the facts to them. So we're asking the citizens of Dallas County, just be patient. We're putting everything we got. This case is a priority for me, and we're going to get there.
I want to ask you one more thing, which is, you know, the nation's eyes turned to Dallas just 2 years ago in July of 2016 when five police officers were shot by someone who was very upset about police shootings of black men. Is that still resonating in Dallas, or what kind of a difference do you think that that made?
Yeah. No, people are still concerned about that. Yes, you know, that will be with us for a long time. We won't ever forget that. Because as I said to you, we support our police officers. These, you know that our police officers, when you really think about what they do, they put their lives on the line every single day. And unfortunately, you have a few bad apples, and we're going to make certain that justice is done.
That's Faith Johnson, who is the district attorney for Dallas County, Texas. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. God bless you.
Earlier this month, Florida Senator Bill Nelson filed a bill in Congress that would provide military veterans with access to medical marijuana. They'd get it at VA facilities in the 31 states where pot is legal. Veterans around the country have said that they want the federal government to reclassify marijuana in a way that would reflect its medical value and open the door to more research on it. Many say they use pot to treat conditions from chronic pain to PTSD. Julio Ochoa from WUSF and the American Homefront Project has more.
Charles Claybaker spent five tours in Afghanistan, carrying out raids against terrorists in a special operations unit. But an aircraft crash in 2010 left the Army Ranger with a crushed leg, hip, and spine in a traumatic brain injury. Army doctors loaded him up with a dozen prescriptions to numb the pain and keep his PTSD in check. But on the pills, Claybaker says he went from a highly trained fighting machine to a zombie for at least 2 hours a day.
But that 2-3 hours, I mean, I'm talking mouth open, staring into space. You know?
And that was for pain?
Pain and the PTSD stuff.
Claybaker decided he would rather live in constant pain. He took himself off the opioids and suffered for 8 months. Then he discovered marijuana. And he says it changed his life.
Yeah, and then so I'll just take a couple of puffs sometimes. You know, it just depends on the day or what's going on or how bad it is.
He says marijuana relieved his pain and helped with his anxiety. Claybaker says marijuana also helped him focus, and he finally started feeling more like himself.
I was a 2013 gold medalist at the Warrior Games in archery. I graduated summa cum laude from Eckerd College. I started my own charity. I actually adopted my 14-year-old brother, who's now on a full-ride scholarship to Oregon State. So, you know, I understand that marijuana has some ills, but for me personally, and I can't speak for everybody else, me personally, it absolutely helped me do all those things.
Claybaker is one of many veterans calling on the federal government to reclassify marijuana so their VA doctors can prescribe it and their insurance will cover it. They also want more research on its medical uses. Right now, pot's illegal under federal law, and that puts big limits on federal dollars needed to study it.
We're realizing that there's a lot of holes here in our knowledge.
That's Ziva Cooper, a professor at Columbia University Medical Center. Last year, Cooper and other researchers published a study that evaluated 10,000 scientific papers in which marijuana was referenced. They found substantial evidence that chronic pain can be reduced by compounds in marijuana known as cannabinoids, including widely sold products like CBD. The report found no scientific studies on marijuana's use for treating PTSD.
We need those rigorous double-blind placebo-controlled studies to inform us if cannabis can actually help with this or cannabinoids.
But the VA says it can't research or prescribe marijuana to veterans unless Congress changes the federal law. New VA Secretary Robert Wilkie says he's got to follow the rules.
I'm not a doctor, never played one on television. I'm not a scientist. I will follow the federal law. And the federal law is very clear.
The American Legion polled its 2 million members and found that 92% favored more marijuana research and 81% support federal legalization. The group has since pushed Congress to change the classification of marijuana to allow more research. That request has gone nowhere. For Here and Now, I'm Julio Ochoa in Tampa.
Dan Fogelman writes stories for the big screen and small that explore the human condition through different perspectives and timelines. Case in point, the hit TV series This Is Us, and now Fogelman's new film, Life Itself. It opens in theaters this week. Dan Fogelman wrote and directed the movie, and we asked him to tell us about how he writes complex stories. First, though, a scene from the film. Actors Oscar Isaac and Olivia Wilde play Will and Abby. They meet in college, marry, and get pregnant, much to the joy of Will's mother, who's played by Jean Smart.
Selfishly speaking, I'm just so glad your parents are dead.
And boom.
Oh, stop it. Abby knows what I mean.
Really? Yeah, she does? You do?
Can I explain?
What I mean is, all I ever wanted was for Will to marry a woman with dead parents so I wouldn't have to share the grandchildren, and he did.
Dan Fogelman, what about that scene we just heard? I wonder if that came out of some therapy session or something, because Jean Smart's character is being incredibly inappropriate, but also truthful and funny. Is this a characteristic, would you say, of your writing and the way your mind works?
Well, I think so. I had a very truthful and funny mother in real life. So that was actually something my mom used to say to me. Yeah. She never was brazen enough to say it to a girlfriend or spouse, but she would say it to me that, Danny, I just hope you just marry a girl whose parents are dead so I don't have to share the grandchildren or the holidays. That was a big deal for my mom.
Little did you know that would work its way into a script sometime.
I know. And ironically, the great irony of the whole thing is my mom passed away. And I got married subsequently to a woman with great parents who got the last laugh, I guess, on my mom
in the saddest
of ways. Yeah.
Oh, wow. You know, that idea of generations and life and death is so much a part of this film. It is the film. And intense feelings. And I want to listen to another scene right now. This is when the first two main characters that we see, Will and Abby, are dating. And Abby expresses some misgivings about being in a relationship with Will. Let's listen to this.
You're the love of my life. I'm sure of it. But sometimes it scares me how much you feel. You know, it's not something I ever thought I would be scared of, but I may not be equipped to be loved this much.
Where did the idea of being equipped to love or handle love come from?
It's something I've always been really interested in, the imbalance that often lives in any relationship, and it doesn't always have to be romantic love interests. I've always been fascinated by how people express love and receive love, and how so often the people who pair up best are people who receive and give in different ways, if that makes any sense. So, yeah, I think it's at the core of who we are in all of our relationships is how we learn to work around each other and love people in the way that they can accept it.
I want to point out that in that scene we just heard, Will and Abby are dressed as John Travolta and Uma Thurman's characters in Pulp Fiction, Quentin Tarantino's film. Another film, as this one does, that really plays with chronology. I wonder, when you have a film like this where things aren't linear in time or in place, and includes individual stories in different times and different places, do you write it that way, or do you kind of do mix and match?
No, I wrote this one straight through.
Straight through the way we see it?
The way you see it.
Wow.
I am not a trained screenwriter, and so when I began writing, I just kind of was self-taught. and I would write in big bursts very quickly. I wrote films in 2 days that got made, but I didn't write very often. And then with this one, I really carefully wrote it over the course of a couple of years and just let the story keep evolving and expanding as I went. And I would often double back and adjust, but it plays in about 5 or 6 different stories. It crosses time and even language. And I just, it really presented itself to me over the course of a longer period of time than I was used to, where I was just writing a bit and I would take a break and I would think about what would come next. And then I would go back to the computer and write some more. I finished it and I said, I think this might actually be something, but I don't quite know how I got from here to there. And that's kind of, hopefully, the experience of watching the film. By the time you've ended your 2 hours in theaters, you're meant to have felt like you went through something. And that was kind of how I felt writing it and finishing it.
You mentioned different languages, in fact, that come up in the film. Let's hear one. It happens to be Spanish. This involves Antonio Banderas, who plays a wealthy landowner who fears that his upbringing has gotten in the way of his achieving happiness.
Tengo muchas cosas increíbles en mi vida, señora González. Pero mi educación tan poco común.
He's saying, I have a great many things in my life, but I fear that my strange upbringing has left me with scars that have kept me from finding the most important things. And he's speaking to the woman he wants to become one of those important things. Hmm. Where did this international angle for you come from?
Yeah, you know, halfway through the film pivots to another continent and pivots to Spanish. It was just something I thought, if I'm going to try and capture a bunch of different feelings and emotions and stories inside of the human experience, it would be nice to not just have it be familiar Americans and to really try and paint from on a wider canvas. And then hoping, you know, that I could put this on screens across the country, and halfway through the movie, it shifts to a 12-minute monologue in Spanish from Antonio Banderas, and waiting to see if the audience is going to go with that or not, an audience who doesn't always go to subtitled film. And it's been a very exciting experience. When you're getting a laugh in Kansas City halfway through a 12-minute monologue in Spanish, a dialogue-based laugh, that's as exciting as it gets for a filmmaker.
When you said a little bit earlier that you want people to come out at the end of the film feeling as though they have been through something, I wonder if some of the ideas here of the unpredictable narrator and life itself being an unpredictable and unreliable narrator, and the idea of life bringing you to your knees, is something that came through as you were writing this, came through from your own life.
It did, yeah, very much so. And I didn't sit down thinking I was writing about anything personal. It was only, frankly, after seeing the movie put together for the first time, where I said, oh, I see psychologically, you know, what I was grabbing at. I was very close with my mom. She died very suddenly and very unexpectedly when I was about 30 years old, about 10 years ago. And it was a body blow that really took me out for quite a while. And almost 1 year to the day after she had passed away, I met my wife, who I would wind up marrying. And I think that's what I was on a personal level really exploring. The strange ups and downs and lefts and rights of life, and the way that if you keep progressing the story and refuse to stop in the dark parts, life is beautiful and romantic and wildly optimistic, even though everything around us is often so dark and cynical right now.
I want you to bring into that theme Bob Dylan,
yeah,
who plays a key role here.
Dylan plays a huge part in the film. He basically serves as the soundtrack for the entire film, specifically the album Time Out of Mind. When I sat down to write, not knowing where I was going, I often put on music and I put on my iTunes, and that album came up and I started writing. And I continued playing the album over and over again. The song that became possibly most recurrent in the film and thematically recurrent is Make You Feel My Love, which was a song I always liked a lot and has been covered a million times.
I could offer you a warm embrace to make you feel my love.
It's a sweet song.
It's a sweet song. And as I was finishing the film, writing it, I was in a bookstore and there was a book of Dylan criticism standing like as an editor's choice in the bookstore in front of me. And I opened it up to the album, and whoever it was, this critic, was really coming after that song. saying that Dylan had created this perfect, beautiful, bleak, tragic,
perfect in its bleakness.
Perfect in its bleakness album. And then smack in the middle of this, he put this one hit love song, and it's the only wart on the album in this guy's mind. And that was where kind of the film gelled to me thematically, and it frankly speaks to what I've always kind of wanted to chase as I try and write and make stuff, which is things can be a lot of different things, and just because there's a lot of ugliness in the world, there can still be a really romantic pop song in the middle of a really bleak album. And to me, that song in that album, I would argue that perhaps it was his point. And that becomes a really prevalent theme in the film.
Well, there's a lot there. Writer-director Dan Fogelman, his new film is called Life Itself. So nice to talk to you. Thank you.
You as well. Thank you.
This week, a federal judge ruled that Georgia does not have to replace its electronic voting machines with machines that create paper records before the election in November. In her ruling, though, the judge noted that she is gravely concerned about Georgia's slow pace addressing the vulnerabilities of electronic voting. So what are those vulnerabilities and how secure are electronic voting machines? Joining us now is Marianne Schneider, who's the president of Verified Voting. That's a nonpartisan nonprofit that advocates for verifiable and secure elections. Marianne, welcome to Here and Now.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And what do you make of the ruling in Georgia this week that the state can go ahead and use electronic voting machines that don't produce a paper record in the upcoming midterms?
Well, I do think that it's a significant decision, but I think that the judge was concerned about the amount of time before the election that there wasn't enough time to smoothly implement paper ballots because there's only 7 weeks between now and the election and the early voting would start soon too. So I think that was a greater concern for the court, but I think the judge made a lot of very significant findings about the vulnerabilities that are present in paperless computer systems that count our votes.
What are those vulnerabilities as you see it?
Well, they're computers, so they can be hacked, and they're no different for voting machines. And so what we advocate for are computers that incorporate a paper record that can be retained for recounts and audits, and that allows jurisdictions to monitor their systems, detect if anything has gone wrong, and respond to it and then recover by, if you have to, hand counting all the paper records.
How many states, or are there a lot of states, that use computers for voting, that do electronic voting machines?
99% of the country counts their votes using computers.
Mm-hmm.
And so 70% of the country already has some kind of paper record with those computers. So whether it's a voter marked paper ballot that is scanned, or whether there's what we call a voter verifiable paper audit trail that is retained in the system.
Have we seen any evidence that there's been any hacking in any of those places where they don't have a paper record?
The short answer to that is no, but the system design is such that it would be very difficult to determine whether there's been any hacking, although we have seen instances of error, you know, programming error. Mm-hmm. I think if in the Georgia case, one of the experts testified, Alex Halderman, who was Verified Voting's technology fellow, he demonstrated that his malware could change all of the logs and all of the records. So even if you looked at it after the fact, it would be very hard to detect that the malware was there.
So why are they used at all if there are questions about their security?
Well, at the time, and turn back the clock about 14 years, they were seen as an improvement over lever machines and punch card machines, and they were considered to be modern. But there's been a shift over the course of the years away from these machines, and now we have the last 30% still out there.
What is your ideal voting system?
So I think that right now, under the state of current technology, a computer like an optical or digital scanner, so that the voter-marked paper ballot, and the ballot is marked either with a pen or a pencil or with a ballot marking device that has accessibility features for voters who can't use a pen or pencil. And then that ballot is scanned and tabulated, and it's retained in the voting system, if necessary for a recount and definitely for an audit, because it's not enough just to have the paper ballot. You have to actually look at it after the fact and check to make sure the software has worked properly. And that's a very important concept, is that we rely on the software, we leverage the technology to make our lives easier, but then we have to check and make sure it worked properly.
So as you look forward to the midterm elections, which are coming up in less than 2 months now, how secure do you think we are against a possible hack?
Well, first of all, there's two things to remember here. There's only one sure way to make sure your vote doesn't count, and that's to not show up. But the second thing is that these are risks, not certainties. So a lot of election management is risk management. So, yes, the machines that don't have paper records require special handling, and there are steps that can be taken to make sure they're as secure as possible, you know, isolating the computers that program them from the Internet, making sure that they're not connected to any networks. And many organizations, especially since 2016, have published the steps that you need to take to make sure that they're as safe as possible. In the jurisdictions that have paper records, there's an ability to detect whether anything has happened and an ability to do a recount if necessary or to do an audit. And so we would recommend that where there are paper records, audits are conducted to make sure that the software has operated correctly. So I think that election officials intend to run as smooth elections as possible. And I think that we saw in 2016 that there are ways to create chaos and disrupt elections that don't involve changing the vote totals with, you know, social media and things like that. So there are definitely areas for improvement, and I would like to see states make those changes as soon as possible.
That's Marian Schneider, who is president of Verified Voting. That's a nonpartisan nonprofit that advocates for secure and verifiable elections. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And remember what she said there. There's one way to make sure your vote doesn't count. Don't show up. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.